A core tenet of Al-Qaeda's strategy is that radical Islamists must gain control of a nation, from which they can then expand the area controlled by believers. Holding a state, in their view, is the prelude to knocking over the dominoes of the world's secular Muslim regimes. Armies achieve victory only when the infantry takes hold of land, Ayman al-Zawahiri has written. Likewise, the Mujahid Islamic movement will not triumph against the world coalition unless it possesses a fundamentalist base in the heart of the Islamic world. The craving for territory is one reason why Al-Qaeda carries out its own terrorist attacks and supports so many national insurgencies. Winning a country will be no easy task, but the stakes are enormous. For only thus can the Muslim nation reinstate its fallen caliphate and regain its lost glory. Al-Zawahiri cites history as proof. Not until Muslim forces in the 12th century united Syria and Egypt could Saladin, a revered figure among jihadists, defeat the Crusaders at the Battle of Hattin in 1187 and retake Jerusalem. Only then did the cycle of history turn against the Crusaders. Bin Laden and his followers had hoped that this germinal state would be Sudan. The country's leaders may have entertained the same thought, but they ultimately did not share the Saudis' vision of how to make that happen. Bin Laden returned to Afghanistan in May 1996, a disappointed man. If there was a hell on earth, this was it. After 17 years of war, the country was utterly destroyed, as failed as a state could be. Nearly 1.5 million people were dead, and at least 2.5 million more were in exile. Afghanistan's irrigation systems were ruined, its livestock herds had shrunk, and much farmland and pasture was unusable because it had been sown with hundreds of thousands of landmines. A bare subsistence was all most people could hope for. Average life expectancy stood at a medieval 46 years. The infant mortality rate, 147 per 1,000, was more than 25 times that in the United States. Public order had vanished. Warring armies ranged across the countryside, and gunmen pillaged, raped, and killed with abandon. One important thing had changed. After years of seesawing battles between rival factions of Mujahideen, a new force emerged determined to end the internecine warfare. The Taliban, literally the students, was born in 1994. There is no shortage of founding myths about the group, but the one most often cited is set in Kandahar province. Two teenage girls had been kidnapped and repeatedly raped by followers of an area warlord. An outraged village cleric, Mullah Muhammad Omar, gathered together 30 students and attacked the camp where the girls were being held. They freed the captives and hanged the group's commander from the barrel of a tank. Soon this small band was raiding the camps of powerful warlords, building stocks of weapons and ammunition, and attracting more students. It drew support from the religiously oriented political parties in Pakistan, which are dominated by Deobandi Muslims who run many of the madrasas, or religious schools, in the Afghan refugee camps and elsewhere. After a series of daring Taliban successes, the Pakistani government began backing the new force as well. Islamabad wanted to break the deadlock among the warring factions that had made Afghanistan ungovernable, blocked trade with Central Asia, and kept refugees from going home. The regime also glimpsed in the Taliban the possibility of breathing life into a creature that could aid its own interests. Within Afghanistan, the Taliban enjoyed a growing popularity. It provided something that ordinary Afghans longed for, a modicum of order. Chaos had reigned for so many years that people had become accustomed to being treated like the chattel of the warlords, or worse. The Taliban vanquished many marauding bands and disarmed troublemakers. But stability came at a price. The Taliban enforced an extreme brand of Islamic practice that had evolved in Afghan villages and refugee camps. Amputations and stonings became common punishments for crimes. Due process had little role in the legal system. One Taliban specialty was to crush those who committed certain infractions, homosexuality is one example, by knocking walls over onto them. Another effect of the rise of the Taliban was that from one day to the next, women were forced out of their jobs, forbidden to appear alone in public, and compelled to wear the head-to-toe burqa. But crime rates fell, and the restoration of some semblance of personal safety in a country that had known none in recent memory, and the evident incorruptibility of the Taliban, attracted recruits in droves. Young men and boys flocked from madrasas in Afghanistan and the refugee camps of Pakistan. Ferocious and unburdened by any tactical caution, the Taliban's war-making was reminiscent of some of the more spontaneous crusades, when hermits or lunatics materialized at the head of a great rabble and swarmed across a continent. Perhaps its strangest personality was its leader, a former mujahid who had lost his right eye in a rocket attack. Mullah Muhammad Omar distinguished himself as one of the world's most reclusive political figures. He almost never gave interviews, especially not to Westerners, and he never allowed himself to be photographed. He was no scholar and had done nothing more exalted than run a small madrasa in his village. But Omar's leadership was unchallenged. He was revered both as a warrior and saint. Omar was uncompromising in his determination that Sharia be the law of the land. In asserting his leadership, he summoned a vision of the miraculous years of Islam. After the capture of Kabul, he assumed the traditional role of the caliph, Amir ul-Mu'minin, commander of the faithful, and the country was renamed the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan.